Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
And I represent the appellant and the plaintiff, Brian Hollins.
And please state your name for the record.
It's Leonard Feldman. Thank you, Judge Becker. In order to affirm the trial court's new trial ruling in this case, this court has to find that both Judge McCullough and Judge Ramseyer abused their discretion in excluding evidence of unrelated injuries.
Why do we have to rule on the correctness of Judge McCullough's decision, given that Judge Ramseyer was the trial judge?
Because, Your Honor, the issue here had an ebb and a flow. When Brian Hollins filed his motion in limine, it was a decision point for the defendants at that point. Are they going to seek to admit this evidence? Or are they going to concede that it's properly excluded? And I think in looking at what happened here, it's profoundly important for this court to see what exactly it was that the defendant said in response to the motion in limine, because that's how we find ourselves where we are today. And the critical point there is that the defendants have conceded in their briefing that Judge McCullough and Judge Ramseyer correctly excluded evidence of the previous neck injuries. So the only issue that's left is whether Judge Ramseyer or Judge McCullough or both properly excluded evidence of the non-neck injuries. And in the response to the motion in limine, which is at CP 96, the defendants devoted two sentences to that issue. That was it, two sentences. And what they said was, defendants will concede that plaintiff is not making a claim for a right wrist injury, left elbow injury, left knee injury, or right hip injury. Defendants do not intend to explore those injuries unless the plaintiff opens the door. And that was how the case began.
But I don't believe there is anything in the record in front of Judge McCullough that would have alerted him to the idea that the decision that he was making was going to mean that when it came to proving damages, that that stuff couldn't come in. I mean, it had to do with pre-existing conditions and injuries.
I think that's an excellent point, and it begs the question, which is, did Brian Hollins open the door? Because if he didn't open the door, there was no reason.
I don't know that opening the door is such a helpful concept here. I mean, the point is that Judge McCullough made a ruling that was, you know, quite normal under the circumstances. But I just don't see how he was given notice that, well, okay, what that means is that when this trial ends and, when we get to the point of proving damages and the plaintiffs say, well, you know, he's claiming that, this had all this effect on his employment, but actually there were all these other things that affected whether he was going to get promoted too. I just don't see anything in the record that shows that Judge McCullough knew that he was excluding those things for that purpose.
No, he was only excluding the evidence of the non-neck injuries as well as the neck injuries.
So if he wasn't excluding them for the purpose that the defendants wanted to use it, then, you know, I just don't see how they had to open the door. They just went on, and then they, as I understand it, they you know, it became clear that they were going to introduce evidence of these non-neck injuries in order to show that there were other possible causes of the claimed damage to his employment prospects.
Right. And then at that point, I think, Your Honor, we get
And then there was this misunderstanding by Judge Ramseyer that somehow that had already been decided by Judge McCullough, even though it doesn't seem to have actually been decided. And gradually she recognized that and said, oh, you know, I made a mistake. It wasn't fair for me to understand it that way and to keep the defendants from being able to explain what other things in the Mr. Hollins' life would have possibly caused him to not have the job that he wanted.
Right. And so at that point, what we get to is the principal issue that we address in our briefing, which is that if defendants wanted to make that argument, they needed expert testimony. These are medical issues. The issue is quite literally, does the injury to his knee affect his damages? Does the injury to his hip affect his damages? And if you look at the respondent's briefing on pages, I think, 14 and 15, there's a list of what these injuries are. And in each instance, there's a surgery that's associated with that injury. So a hip replacement, for example. If it is the defendant's position that Mr. Hollins quit his job because of the injury to his hip, it's not sufficient under Washington law to simply cross-examine him on that. They need an expert witness who will testify that because of the manner in which his hip was replaced, he's not able to do his job at Providence.
Isn't that inconsistent with the Colley versus Peace Health?
I'm familiar with the issue, Your Honor, that defendants in MedMal cases have a slightly different burden than the plaintiffs.
Well, they don't have a burden, actually.
Well, in this particular case, what's critically important is that the defendants took upon themselves the position of the plaintiff. They weren't poking holes in Mr. Hollins' testimony that it was the neck injury that prevented him from doing his job. They had their own alternative causation argument.
Well, how would you distinguish Colley, or are you, or maybe you're not familiar enough with it to be able to answer the question?
I'm not familiar enough with it to be able to answer the question, but I am familiar with the different burdens that apply in medical malpractice cases as to a defendant poking holes in the plaintiff's case. But that's not our situation, because as I said, what the defense was trying to do here was akin to what a plaintiff does. Their argument, it was an alternative causation argument, was that the hip caused the harm, the ankle caused the harm, the elbow caused the harm. Now, they had conceded causation, so there's a question about whether they could even make that argument. But
caused
if
the harm, you mean
caused him
whether,
to,
whether it impacted his ability to do his job.
Yes, yes. And that was not just...
So you're saying they had to prove that those things did impact his ability to do his job.
Correct.
And they didn't.
And they didn't. And
time is short here. Let me just redirect your attention. In your briefing, you raised four reasons why this was not a situation where the defendant was deprived of a fair trial. In Judge Ramsire's oral and written decisions, I don't recall seeing those matters being covered. Could you address that, please?
Yes, and what she found was that they were deprived of a fair trial because the evidence was excluded, and that conflates the fair trial consideration with the abuse of discretion consideration. What we argue in our briefs is that there were four reasons they weren't deprived of a fair trial. Defendants got this evidence in anyway. There was a curative instruction that eliminated any evidence post-2012. The proximate cause instruction is critically important. The jury was instructed, and we presume that they followed the instruction, to award only those damages that were proximately caused by this harm. And then lastly, and then I'll conclude, the case law is crystal clear that in order to find that there's a deprivation of a fair trial, the verdict has to be irreconcilable with the evidence. And the defendants argued that the damages award, and remember, liability and causation are conceded, so we can only talk about damages. The defendants argued that it was excessive, and Judge Ramsire rejected that argument. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Kelly Sweeney. I'm pleased to represent the Zabarachuks. We ask that this court affirm Judge Ramsire's correct decision, granting the order for a new trial following an over $2 million verdict stemming from a non-surgical cervical injury that Mr. Holland suffered in an admitted liability motor vehicle accident. Really, the two issues before the court, as you've already got into with Mr. Feldman, is whether there was medical testimony that was required to establish evidence that would go toward damages. And ultimately, I was able to convince Judge Ramsire that really we were talking about two separate issues, which were causation, which had been established, and then also damages. And it was really, as the court I'm sure is aware, it ultimately Judge Ramsire came to the correct decision in that the Zabarachuks were prevented from a fair trial because significant both pre-accident conditions and impairments and surgeries.
Did you take the plaintiff's deposition prior to trial?
Pardon me?
Did you take the plaintiff's deposition
prior to trial?
Yes, I did. Did he testify to what his injuries were?
Yes, he did.
At at trial, did he testify to the same injuries?
No, that was the crux of the problem. He was not allowed to, I was not allowed to elicit that type of evidence from Mr. Hollins.
So he testified to things in his deposition that he didn't, that he, that you're saying, you asked him questions in the deposition that you were not able to ask him at trial.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes. And before,
if you had been able to ask those questions, I wonder if you could just kind of depict for us how the case would have gone differently. In other words, at your closing argument, you would have said what?
Sure. Well, first of all, Mr. Hollins talked about being surprised when he received information that he was disabled, that he was now having to deal with a disability. Well, we know that Mr. Hollins, that was not the first time that he had heard those words from a medical provider. He had a 24% impairment for a left hip injury and a 25% permanent impairment for following four knee surgeries. So that would have been one thing that I would have addressed in terms of just a general damages argument, that Mr. Hollins had not, as he really, the jury was only able to hear what a surprise and what a shock it was to him that he was now dealing with a permanent impairment from a 5 to 8% cervical injury, whereas he's already been dealing with a 24% permanent injury for another body part and a 25% permanent injury for another body part following multiple surgeries. He never even had the cervical surgery in this case. That is a little confusing. Well, I shouldn't assume that it was confusing for the court, but Mr. Hollins decided not to call Dr. Yalamanchili, which would have been the doctor who even talked about potentially doing the cervical surgery. And there was an issue because no doctor had ever testified on a more probable than not basis that Mr. Hollins actually even needed a cervical surgery. And so, again, the jury, unfortunately, was led to believe that Mr. Hollins was a very healthy man, had never been told he was disabled or impaired in any way.
Let me ask you this question about the order that Judge McCullough entered. Excuse me. The relief he granted was excluding any and all evidence, references to evidence, testimony, or other argument relating to, and then he lists the different. Why didn't you, at the time, object to that order as being overly broad? Why didn't you argue at that time to Judge McCullough that he only should be limiting this as to certain issues, not excluding it from the trial in toto, as he did?
Sure. Well, if hindsight was 20/20, I wish that we would have done that. But again, I guess the answer to that, Your Honor, is that the concern there was that it was going toward causation. And our issue at the trial and how the trial developed was one of allowing evidence to go toward damages, and those are two separate concepts.
But you knew that at the time, right? I mean,
sure.
All of this had been taken care of because you're what, 2 weeks away, 3 weeks away from picking a jury? It was fairly close.
Yes. Yes.
So you got an order from a judge, and it refers to evidence that you intend to have admitted on the issue of damages. And it excludes it, and the exclusion is without limitation. I really don't understand why it wasn't litigated at the time. It may not have been admissible for this purpose, Judge, but certainly I should be able to admit it for this other purpose.
Well, a couple of things, and I think as Mr. Feldman already has alluded to, and the court is aware, I mean, jury trials and even the weeks and the days leading up to jury trials, things ebb and flow. And really, Mr. Hollins' theory of the case in terms of his claim for damages changed, even just prior to trial. Originally, it was a claim that he was unable to do two jobs at the same time.
I want to harken back to the first thing I asked you, which was, did you take his deposition and did you ask him about these things that you weren't
absolutely
able to ask?
Absolutely.
So you seem to be very competent. So you're reading a letter, you know, if you or not a letter, but an order, and you know it's excluding you from asking questions that you asked at the deposition and that you presumably want to ask at the trial. I'm just trying to get my handles on how did this not get fully litigated in front of Judge McCullough?
Right. Well, thank you for the compliment, Your Honor. This was unique in that it was another attorney in my office that had been handling this case. For scheduling purposes only, I ended up taking the deposition of Mr. Hollins. But at that time, I was not intending to actually try the case. As the matter came to be in our office and as this case kind of changed in terms of how it was being presented, I stepped in and then tried the case. So I, at the first opportunity to address the issue again with Judge Ramsire, I took that opportunity. And it was, and so in hindsight, to answer your question, yes, in a perfect scenario, number one, I would have been responding to the motion in limine. I would have been arguing the motion in limine, and I hopefully would have convinced Judge McCullough to not rule so specifically. And then to go in further, I perhaps would have brought some type of motion for reconsideration on that motion in limine or otherwise. But instead, at the time of trial, when it was Judge Ramsire, knowing now that that motion in limine had been ruled upon, but also understanding that it's totally appropriate for the trial court to revisit motions in limine during the context of the trial, I was hopefully banking on the fact that I would have that opportunity to revisit that motion. And that's exactly what I did during the testimony of Mr. Hollins, when he first then testified about being surprised about the disability diagnosis, and also when he testified about continuing to treat past December of 2012. And again, that's what was significant, because I knew at that time that he had not been treating for anything related to this car accident past September 2012. He had, in fact, been continuing to treat for his hip and his knee and his elbow and all of the other conditions in 2012 and beyond, but yet Mr. Hollins wanted to prevent the jury from knowing that. But that was the opportunity that I took with Judge Ramsire to then revisit, and it was in the context of that Mr. Hollins opened the door at that point in terms of being allowed to testify that, oh no, I continue to treat for my neck. But really, it was because he was going to the chiropractor and the physical therapy and doing other things in conjunction with other body parts that he didn't want the jury to know about. So, to again, hopefully answer your question, Your Honor, that yes, I would have liked to address that earlier,
Let me just ask this one, too. I'm curious about opening the door, okay? Because it seems like we've got an order that's a blanket order. It's pretty all-encompassing. And it doesn't sound like any of the facts really change in terms of the case sort of was the case that went to trial at the time of it. So, I mean, is this really that somehow a door was opened, or is this just the ruling was wrong to begin with?
I would say both, Your Honor. I would say both. And I think Judge Ramsire recognized both, that not only was the door opened, but also the decision that she was capable of making in the context of the entire trial and having the benefit of being the trial judge and seeing how Mr. Hollins was presenting, seeing how the information was coming out. I think that it was appropriate for her to revisit that ruling at that time, and the motion in limine at that time. Just briefly, I would argue again, Your Honors, that the standard of review here is abuse of discretion. There was no abuse of discretion by Judge Ramsire in terms of granting a motion for new trial. A much stronger showing of an abuse of discretion is required. And again, just briefly, in terms of the Hoskins case and the Harris case and all of those cases, they're not on point in that they deal with the same body condition. This is a totally separate issue. We were talking about other areas of his body, which all went toward damages and all went to whether he was able to perform the job that he said he could no longer do based only on his subjective complaints of pain, and it was all information that went and the jury should have been allowed to consider in terms of their overall damages award. Judge Ramsire reached the right decision. We ask that you affirm it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Becker, I think you asked Ms. Sweeney an excellent question, which is what would the closing arguments have looked like? And the problem with her answer was that what she was describing is what the case law proscribes, which is that she was asking the jury to speculate. Mr. Hollins has had a number of procedures and a number of injuries. Now, of course, he worked just fine with those.
The case law that you're thinking of is what, precisely?
The case law that we cite are the multiple injury cases. And Allen
versus Mattoon.
Right. Allen versus Mattoon is where there were two automobile accidents, and the defendant tried to argue that one of those accidents was the true cause. And what the court found, and this is in the statement of facts in that decision, was that there wasn't medical testimony. And under the Cawley decision, which you cited, it is absolutely true, that, as you know, that defendants in medical malpractice cases don't have a more probable than not standard or burden. But they still have to have expert testimony, because the cases make it very clear that when you are trying to show causation or damages, which really can't be divorced from causation.
Well, but there's causation of injury, and then there's the question of whether the injury causes other sorts of damages to enjoyment of life and employment and so forth. It strikes me that the Mattoon case, and really the question that was in front of Judge McCullough, had to do with the causation of the neck injury, and that there were not pre-existing conditions. It was to get rid of that kind of an argument. It wasn't to say that nothing that ever happened to Mr. Hollins could never be discussed in terms of his life and how he was enjoying it and whether he could work or not. I mean, you don't have to have medical testimony to suggest that an injury makes somebody impairs their ability to work if you're a defendant.
I believe you do.
And your case would be?
Allen.
Okay, so you're relying on Allen.
I'm relying on Allen, and I would urge the court to read the Voitkin decision as well, which is out-of-state authority, but very clear on this
point. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Our final case this morning is O.S.